You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everybody, thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Cashman, and this is our weekly look at the American League Central. This week, the red-hot Indians. Can anybody stop them? We'll talk to Jordan Bastian about that. We'll talk to Jeffrey Flanagan about a Royals team that is not accustomed to being in second place and how they can handle that moving forward. The Chicago White Sox, what are they going to do at the trade deadline? Buy, sell, hold? We'll talk to Scott Merkin about that. The Detroit Tigers cannot beat the Indians, and that's had a huge impact on their season, so they're another team that's going to have some big trade deadline questions to answer. We'll talk to Jason Beck about that, and Rhett Bollinger will join us to talk about the latest involving the Minnesota Twins. Here we go. Talk about the second place Royals, Jeffrey, because the Indians just can't lose a game right now. Take me to the mentality of the Royals clubhouse, obviously not accustomed to playing from behind this late in the season, given the way last year went. But what's their thought process right now?
Well, I think the thought process is that at some point the Indians will actually have to lose a game. I mean, I don't think they can run the table from here, but very impressed with them. They have been the last couple of years. I mean, they really thought that the Indians would do what they're doing this year, last year. So they're not surprised at all by what they're doing, but pretty focused on their own business right here. They've, you know, been kind of a peak and valley team. They did, you know, lose two in a row to the Astros and two to the Mets. So, you know, you have that four-game slide, and now they've kind of straightened out, won a couple in a row. That's just kind of where their season's been. You know, they win eight in a row, they lose eight in a row, and right now just kind of battling for some consistency.
Peaks and valleys sums it up with Kendrys Morales this year. Much of the year was a valley, to be honest. And then he's certainly in a peak now. Four hits in Monday's win over the Cardinals. Two homers in Sunday's win over the Astros. He's got hits in eight of his last 12 at-bats going into Tuesday's play. What has gotten into this guy after the way he started the season?
Well, to be honest, I think we've talked about this before. When he was, you know, when the results weren't there earlier in the year, his exit velocity was still pretty high on the team. He was hitting a lot of rockets right at people and a lot of rockets right into the ship. And so, I mean, his numbers were awful and it looked really bad. But now you see some balls starting to drop in. Of course, you had the home runs. But like last night, he hit two line drives that, you know, just got over the shift in right field. He hit a ground ball to the left side of the infield through the open space. Hit a fly ball that the wind kind of took in the opposite field and went off the wall. So, you know, some of it's bad luck, some of it was bad hitting, but, you know, now he's getting some good fortune. He's kind of changed a couple things in his stance. He's trying to get more backloaded so he has a proper weight shift, and you're seeing him drive the ball a little bit more. But, you know, to be honest, I don't see a drastic change in him from what he's doing now than what he did 2 months ago. I just think the balls are starting to drop in.
All right, so before we recorded, I mentioned the rotation, and I just obviously I'm watching from afar, and it just seems to me it's had trouble getting traction this season. And, you know, obviously it stands out when Volquez has an outing like he had the other day.
Yeah.
But you pointed out that the rotation's probably been better than most people realize. You know, a couple of those jarring outings withstanding, it's overall had some a little bit of traction here in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, they had a streak right before those horrible hiccups against the Astros where they had 11 straight starts with an ERA of about something like 2.88 or something like that, which will really play in the American League. And then, of course, you have Eddie's start where he knew in the bullpen, he said, you know, he told Dave Island, the pitching coach, he goes, I've got nothing. I got absolutely nothing. The ball's not moving. And Dave said something like, well, maybe when you get to the real mound, you know, something will happen. And it didn't. I mean, the Astros just pounded him, just rockets everywhere. And the very next night, you know, Chris Young experienced the same thing. So you had those two horrible starts, but then you come back and get a terrific start from Ian Kennedy on Sunday, probably his best outing of the year. Arguably Danny Duffy's best outing of the year last night. So basically 13 out of 15 starts have been very, very good. Just two really bad ones that, you know, jack up the team ERA. But I think Ned Yost and the staff feel like they're finally getting a little bit of consistency out of the rotation. And, you know, if Eddie can bounce back and Chris Young can bounce back, who knows, they might, and with Morales in the lineup getting hot and Gordo back, they might finally look like the world champions of last year.
And that Volquez outing was so bad, you almost just totally toss it out as a total outlier. One of the worst starts in history, frankly, a minus 12 game score, which I did not think was possible. We had 12 runs and 8 hits. But, you know, Jeffrey, if you toss out that outing, and I'm sure he'd like to, he still has a 5.18 ERA in 4 June starts. But one of those 4 starts was an outstanding one against the Indians, tossed in the middle there. So it's just kind of a weird month for Volquez. What do you make of, you kind of juxtapose that start against the Tribe against what's gone on in his other few outings?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, you know, that's a good point. It's a fair point because Eddie has not been the pitcher he was last year. It's been a little puzzling. He'll toss in a really good-looking start, and then, you know, a couple of below-mediocre ones, and then, you know, obviously the worst start we've seen in a long time. And the funny thing about that start was there wasn't one softly hit ball. There were no bloopers. I mean, they were just like batting practice rockets all over the field. So, you know, he just didn't have anything on his fastball. His sinker wasn't working. Everything was drifting over the middle of the plate. But if you know Eddie just kind of, he really did just kind of laugh it off afterward. He goes, hey, this stuff happens in the big leagues. I've seen it before. Watch me. I'll bounce back the next start. And, you know, he's a hard guy to doubt after what he did last year in the regular season and, of course, the World Series. So, they'd certainly like, he's been kind of considered their ace, so to speak, since last year. And they'd really like to see him, you know, throw together 4 or 5 consistently really good starts.
Merck. As we record this, we're going into Tuesday here, 12 games left before the All-Star break for the Chicago White Sox. And as you pointed out in your latest story at MLB.com, 9 of those 12 are at home. 6 are against the Twins and Braves, who have each of their league's worst records. So this is obviously, it's always an important stretch just before the break, kind of know where you're sitting going into the ceremonial midway mark. But for this club, it feels particularly important because Rick Hahn's got some decisions to make.
Yeah, you know, Rick Hahn talked to the media at the beginning of the homestand like he usually does and said there's no magical day or no magical mark over 500 that, you know, lets him decide whether he should make, you know, 2 moves, 3 moves, 1 move, no move, whatever, you know, how aggressive he's going to be, basically. But I would say, I think it's a pretty safe guess, you know, when you have 3 at home against the Twins, 3 on the road against Houston, which should be a very interesting series, 3 at home against the Yankees, who are kind of in the same boat as the Sox, and 3 at home against Atlanta. If you go 4-8 or 5-7 somehow on that, I think 500 is even, you know, okay. But if you go below 500, I think you got a pretty, you know, hard fight to come back from in the second half. They're at 500 as we tape this. Now, it's not to say they have to go out and go 10-2 and they have to sweep, you know, Minnesota and Atlanta because they're bad teams. People lose to both those teams, obviously. They have talent. They're a major league squad. But it's a big stretch to show what direction they are. You know, they're kind of in the same boat as last year, although they're a better team this year. You know, last year they had one really good stretch where they won 7 in a row going right into the trade deadline. They got within, I want to say, a game and a half or 2 games of the second wild card spot. And, you know, the Sox didn't want to give up top prospects to add on at that point. And they ended up making the right decision because they, you know, fell under 500 and fell well short of the playoffs. This year, I think, you know, they're a more complete team, although not complete. And once again, though, with the way Cleveland's playing, they may be looking at a wild card type situation. It's a little early still with so many head-to-head games with Cleveland. But just the way the Indians have kind of separated themselves, you wonder if that's the case. So then you have to weigh, you know, as the White Sox, what do you give up in order to get something back? Do you feel like if you get in the wild card game with Chris Sale or Jose Quintana as your pitcher, you've got a shot to get to the next round, so you go all in, so to speak, or do you kind of, you know, maybe go a level down in acquiring people? But I think these 12 games, while not setting the final decision, because you do have 6 in the West Coast and Anaheim and Seattle after the All-Star break, we'll go a long way to deciding that. They need to be over 500. They need to go into the break, I would say, over 500 after this 12-game stretch.
Yeah, the scenario I don't see, and I'm sure it'll be talked about just because we need stuff to talk about at the trade deadline, but the White Sox could lose all 12 of these games, and I don't think they would trade Chris Sale or Jose Quintana. I just don't see it happening in season. And I get it, it's a shallow pitching market, and they could get a haul for either of those guys, but I just don't see things going that far south that quickly that, you know, suddenly you rethink your entire organization.
No, if they went 0-12, I don't think that would be a real good scenario either. But I think
well, of course not. But I don't think it changes your entire outlook.
You made a good point. But I, as far as I remember,
I don't think it's a very deep market in the offseason for free agent pitchers either, right? Now with Steven Strasburg signing with the Nationals. So in the offseason, you can pretty much engage, if you want to go in that direction, which they have not even given the slightest inclination that they're going to do that. Now you can engage everyone in the offseason, you know, whether it's a great team, a mediocre team, or whatever. And I realize that maybe if you think of trading one of them now, you might have a good team kind of over the barrel and can ask for a little bit more. But I think, you know, it works just as well. Here's the thing about Sale is I think with, you know, what's happened with the Cubs and what's happened with Houston and what's happened with Kansas City when they traded Greinke, so forth and so on, that's just the default situation now. Oh, this team's struggling. They need to rebuild. Let's trade the best player and get seven guys back that can help the team. Well, it doesn't always work that way, first of all. And second of all, in Chris Sale, you have a guy who's still under contract with a couple options, I believe, for three more years, and you have a guy who wants to be there. This is not a guy who's saying, well, when I go free agent or at the end of this year, I don't want to come back. I want to be traded. This is a guy who wants to be there, and he wants to not necessarily be the face of the team. He's not requesting that, but is comfortable being one of the leaders, is comfortable stepping up and saying things when he feels it needs to be said, as he did in the, you know, situation in spring training. So this is not a guy you need to get rid of. This is a guy you build a team around. And people will say, well, you've already had, you know, what, five of his prime years as a starter and four so far, and you're not really even gone anywhere. Well, you know, all it takes is 1 year to click. So you build around him and you build the core around him, is my opinion. Same with Quintana. But, I mean, I don't think you trade him just because it's magically going to turn your team around. There's no guarantee of that. You have a guy that teams will overpay by millions and millions to get. So why trade him at this point?
Exactly. One more point on Sale, and we're thinking a little bit ahead here, a couple weeks ahead, but, you know, you kind of look at the landscape, and it's hard to identify American League starting pitcher for the All-Star game. If you go by reputation and pedigree and all these things, I think it's Chris Sale. I know Robin Ventura feels that way. He said the other day, he's the best. You can say I'm biased or not. He's still the best. I would tend to agree with that. But then if you want to get, you know, down to the statistics of it all, and we know Sale had a couple rough outings in the last month or so, you know, right now there's a great case for Steven Wright, the knuckleballer who, you know, barely makes the rotation out of camp and ends up having a great season for the Red Sox. Within the division, Danny Salazar, Quintana himself has a bit of a case if you want to get into the stats. But I don't know. I just have this feeling it's going to be Chris Sale. I could be wrong.
In an interesting side note, last year when they had won the seven in a row, they were going for their eighth straight, a second four-game sweep. They had swept Cleveland in four, taking the first three from Boston, and it was Sale against Steven Wright, and Boston ended up winning that game, and that pretty much, and not putting it all on Sale, obviously, but that kind of changed the landscape. They went home, they had a bad homestand, and they were 3-6 in the homestand, and that was pretty much the end. But, yeah, I think it's, you know, there are some interesting scenarios, and he has two more starts against Houston and Atlanta. And granted, Houston's playing about as well as anyone right now, but if you look at the numbers, Sale just dominates the Astros, just absolutely owns the Astros. So that should be good for his stats. And then the Braves are not, you know, they're the worst team in baseball along with Minnesota. So, it should be, there's a chance he goes into the break 15-2 with an ERA well below 3. But the other choices you make are also good cases too. And Sale will be on target the way they have him start. I believe he's starting Saturday and the following Friday, so he would be available to start that game. Steven Wright's a great story. He's been pretty much the lone consistent force right on that Boston starting rotation this year. And Salazar is, you know, probably the ace, or, you know, one of the aces, I guess, which is one of the reasons Cleveland is so good, but probably the most consistent guy they've had this year for, you know, the best team in that division. I think all three are good options, but I think this may be Sale's turn. This will be, barring something completely unexpected, Sale's fifth straight year as an All-Star. So every year he's been a starter. He pitched part of 1 year as a reliever and then one full year as a reliever. Every full year he has been a starter. Chris Sale has been will be an All-Star. And I think there would be a strong case, you know, because of that, you know, kind of the body of work, that Chris would be the starter this year.
JB, you are the good luck charm, or the bad luck charm, depending on how you look at it. But I'm guessing the next time you walk through that clubhouse, you're going to be shooed out of there.
Yeah, maybe I'm former beat reporter. I don't know. Maybe this will be like Office Space, and they just haven't told me I'm fired. And I'm going to make that trip to Toronto and just pretend like I still have a job. We'll see if they let me in to the manager's desk, and I'm sure Terry Francona will have some nice quips ready for me when I do show my face you know, and obviously luck is not on my side when I do show up. We'll be playing a good Toronto team, and there might be a loss there, and I will be blamed for it.
Oh, my God. He's already making excuses, folks. All right, so what do you make of this? Because obviously there is things – when you win 10 games in a row, there are real things that are happening within that. There are outlandish things that are happening within that. I would say, you know, the offense scoring north of 6 runs a game is not something you count on for the rest of the season by any stretch of the imagination, but there are certainly good signs within that. What's your general takeaway from what's going on here the last week and a half?
Well, I think what we're seeing is the best-case scenario for the way this team was constructed. I think the reason that, you know, kind of all those projection systems were so high on the Indians was strong starting pitching. Obviously, you mentioned the offense is a little bit more than expected, but, you know, a good enough offense and extremely strong run prevention to go with a solid bullpen. And I think over the course of a long season, you know, when the stars align with those components, you can have an incredible hot streak like this. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing, is we're seeing exactly why, you know, everyone thought the Indians could be very good this year. You know, we're seeing incredible starting pitching. Obviously, some of that's going to come back down to earth a little bit. And we're seeing, obviously, the good defense, and the offense has been kind of in one of those incredible strong stretches where up and down the lineup, you know, they're getting on some incredible runs, whether it's 4 triples in a game or 4 homers in an inning. You know, I think we've just seen the Indians at their peak and why they are a team that has, I think, sustainability when it comes to contending for the playoffs.
So everybody, myself included, you know, wrote and said very nice things about the Indians' rotation going into the year. Yeah, I said at the time, it's an elite unit, but it's an elite unit because of the front three, because of Corey Kluber and, you know, Carrasco's had 2 monster second halves the last couple of years. And Danny Salazar is probably their best starter last season, and still room for more growth there. But then after that, you know, very significant question marks. And Trevor Bauer was one of them, to the point that he wasn't even in the rotation on opening day and spent some time in the bullpen. But 6 strong innings against the Braves on Monday night. And in the month of June, a 190 average against, 529 OPS against, a 2.01 ERA and 6 starts. He's been basically one of the best starters in baseball over the last month or so. And it just seems like, JB, he's figuring out that you don't have to overthink this. And if you throw strikes and locate, you can succeed at this level. You don't have to kind of reinvent the wheel. He's been, I think Terry Francona even used the word conventional. He's been a little more conventional in his approach. And that, to me, is as encouraging as anything else that's happened in this last, you know, in this recent stretch.
Yeah, I think we're seeing sort of the evolution of what the last 3 years of overhauling his delivery, then sort of, you know, kind of having a stubbornness with his approach, and then using an offseason to increase his velocity, and, you know, kind of button heads here and there with the pitching coach and Francona, but in the end, sort of finding this middle ground of his own philosophies and what the team has for their pitching philosophies. And all that progress he's made with his delivery behind the scenes is kind of all coming together, and we're seeing he's still doing, you know, that up and in approach with the fastball, but really becoming more of a sinker based pitcher. The 2 seam has overtaken the 4 seam in terms of his usage. We have seen an uptick in the velocity on all the pitches, so much so that his slider doesn't even register as a slider anymore with PitchFX. It registers as a cutter now. We're seeing all these things kind of combined, and then he's kind of got his own personal catcher now with Chris Giménez, who's kind of one of the unsung heroes right now in this stretch. You know, while Yan Gomes has struggled, Giménez has really stepped up, not only as Bauer's personal catcher in other games as well, but with Bauer specifically, you know, they've really worked well, you know, planning ahead day before starts. And, yeah, kind of going back to this really simple approach that, you know, they always joke around that those pitcher meetings are the up and in, down and away meetings. But we're kind of seeing that with Bauer, that he's buying into that quote-unquote conventional philosophy while sort of staying true to some of his own approaches to pitching. And I think the results have been fantastic. We're not seeing many reverse sliders or, you know, the seventh or eighth or ninth pitches in his repertoire, you know, we're kind of seeing him rely on a similar formula start to start. And his curveball has been, I think, one of the best pitches on the staff this season. You know, we're seeing great, great strides with him, and it's very encouraging. This is a guy that the Indians had hoped to see, and they're finally seeing it.
Another guy you hope to see, you know, perform the way he did at the minor league level was Lonnie Chisenhall, and we all know it's been, you know, fits and starts in his big league career, but he's hot right now. Last six games, he's hitting .458 with 5 extra base hits and 9 RBI. We've seen him get hot like this in the past, mm-hmm. JB. You just wonder, especially, you know, given the general context of the conversation of, you know, is this team going to go after an outfield bat this summer? You know, it's a good time for Chisenhall to get hot for sure.
Yeah, it is, and you're right. We have seen it. We saw it, you know, the Texas game a couple of years ago. Obviously, it's the first thing to come to mind, that 3-homer, 9 RBI, 5-for-5 game, and everyone thought it was a corner turned, and it turned out that it was kind of the peak, and then he really struggled down the stretch that year. And we've seen him have very high peaks and very low valleys, and I think that his propensity for, you know, being an aggressive hitter, he does not going to draw a lot of walks. You know, I think that lends itself to having those kinds of streaks. I think we've seen that with Yan Gomes as well. And so, yeah, I think, again, you got to kind of ride it while you can. I think he's been, since he's been in right field, there is more of a comfort level defensively. Maybe that's carried over to himself in terms of comfortability and confidence as a hitter and things like that. So, you know, it's been good to see him hitting. And, again, with this lineup, as we've talked about for years now, you know, when the Indians can't put that true run-producing kind of mega slugger in the middle of the lineup, they've got to produce a lineup that from 1 through 9 is very, very deep. And when you're talking about Chisenhall being, you know, in the sixth or lower in that lineup and hitting the way he can, you know, that's a great sign for this lineup, and that's exactly what this lineup has to be.
Beck, you know, the Tigers have basically been a 500 team. They are a 500 team as we record this season, and you just think about how different things might look if they had any success whatsoever against the Cleveland Indians. I'm stunned by this team's 0-9 record against the Tribe. Of course, where it was swept in Detroit last weekend. And the reason I'm so stunned is it goes so far against the trend of the last few seasons where Detroit has really dominated the Indians. So what do you think has been the difference in this particular matchup?
I think the starting pitching has been huge. You know, the Indian starters who in the past have really struggled against our Tigers lineup, really almost to a man, they've broken through, and they've been able to keep these bats quiet. They've mainly, I think most impressively to me is, you know, just how quietly they've kept Cabrera. You know, they've found that middle ground of pitching him inside, but still sending him up to get him out over the plate to, you know, maybe him chase a little bit. You know, they've gotten into his head a little bit, I think, and that makes a big difference. But it's not just him. It's up and down the lineup. You know, Saturday's game, I think, was a very good example where, you know, just what Carrasco was able to do to these guys. Yeah. Here's a guy that the Tigers were able to hit pretty hard over the previous few years. And like a lot of other guys right now, I mean, he's got their number.
Absolutely, yeah, and to your point, to the grander point, the Tigers' rotation ERA is about a run higher than that of the Indians, and that makes a huge difference, of course, over the course of the season. And we can break down the Tigers any number of ways. We can talk about, you know, Justin Upton's early struggles or J.D. Martinez being out currently, or the bullpen has certainly been a factor. But really, by and large, when you're not getting consistent starting pitching, it's really tough to get much traction, and that's kind of been the struggle all season. You know, Verlander has been really good on the whole this season. And two of his – he's probably had three outings that really stick out to you, and two of them have come against the Indians specifically. But you look at the rest of the rotation, and we identified Anibal Sanchez as kind of a huge X factor going into the season. And obviously, things not work out there, and then he spends a month in the bullpen. He comes back to start against the Tribe over the weekend, gives up 4 runs in 5 innings, including 2 home runs. So, you know, it'd be nice if the storyline was always seamless and a guy kind of spends a month in the wilderness and comes back better for it. But
obviously, if that first start is indication, redemption is not yet at hand for Anibal Sanchez.
No, and yeah, I remember going into the season talking about how they needed Sanchez to be kind of that front line or number three starter, and if you get that, it allows you to look at Pelfrey as more of a back end guy and not need too much out of him. Well, I mean, you look at it now, and they've gotten virtually nothing out of either of them, and I think that's a big reason why the rotation right now is just in so much flux. Yeah, Verlander's been up and down, and Zimmerman's kind of fallen on hard times lately after coming back from that groin injury. But you know, Sanchez is really, you look at him and you think back to that guy who won the AL ERA title a few years ago, and you wonder where that guy's gone. And I've been surprised by his inability or his struggles to get consistent outs and to adapt his game with a loss of velocity. Here's a guy I thought could make the transition maybe even better than Verlander could, at least quicker, that he was a guy who, you know, could make those type of tweaks and adjustments to his game. And you look at the fastball velocity drop, and you look at the rise in batting average, and especially in slugging percentage the last couple of years, accompanied by that meteoric rise in home runs allowed, and it almost goes hand in hand. Here's a guy who's struggling to find that form. And, you know, is it injury related? You know, who knows? Maybe somewhat, but he's still pitching and he's avoided the disabled list. But he's not that effective pitcher right now. And it's created this gaping hole in the Tigers rotation where they need somebody to step up. And when you combine that with Pelfrey, right now, if this team has a second-half surge in them, I think it's going to have to be led by some of the younger pitchers. I think Daniel Norris is going to have to take on a bigger role than you would like, simply because right now they don't have the arms to do otherwise.
Yeah, going into Pelfrey's start against the Marlins on Tuesday, Pelfrey and Sanchez have combined to post a 5.87 ERA across 26 starts this season, and the Tigers have lost 18 of those 26 games started by those two guys. So obviously a trend that has to change, or as you said, Beck, a young guy has to step up. Let's talk about Norris a little bit because he did make his first start at the big league level last week, and he'll get another opportunity Wednesday against the Marlins. What was the takeaway from that first time out, and what's his outlook moving forward?
Stuff is good. He tired a little bit near the end. Command. I think his command was kind of what you expect when you look at the numbers he had down in AAA. He's having a little bit of that learning process after such an encouraging stretch run last year. You kind of see him trying to do too much sometimes, maybe a little bit, maybe trying to throw too perfect of a pitch. He'll work through that, though. You know, the arm's healthy, what I think is big. He's healthy, which I think is even bigger. Yeah, I mean, body-wise, overall, health-wise, he's good. Now I think we need to get him repetitions. We need to get him along in that process. We need him to learn some lessons here. He's going to have to learn on the fly, and he's going to have to provide some innings, which you look at the track record, granted, not that it's a long history with him, but it's going to be a little bit up and down. But he's going to have to stretch out that pitch count a little bit and let him go and give him some room to learn how to attack guys second, maybe third time through the order, and see how to adjust his game. Learn the mental approach as much as physical.
Joined by Rhett Bollinger, who had a look at the Twins from afar last week. Rhett was in South Korea, in Byung-ho Park's native land, and checking out the sites there. And a lot of baseball sites there, Rhett, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely a baseball-crazy country. They love their baseball out there in Korea. Everywhere you look, there's fans wearing MLB hats, especially now with Byung-ho Park, a lot of Twins hats. But obviously a lot of Dodgers hats. I think Ryu's the most popular player still over there. Jung-ho Gong with the Pirates is a fan favorite as well as Kim with the Orioles. So a lot of MLB hats, and then the games there are amazing. The game's great atmosphere. They have a chance for every single player to come up to the plate. So, they go up there, and their fans are banging on drums and in the thunder sticks, and you've got cheerleaders and an MC for each team, and it's on both sides, too. So like the, you know, visiting side of their own side of the stadium where they have their cheers and their, you know, kind of fans, and the home team has their other side. So, I mean, it's kind of this crazy atmosphere kind of going back and forth. And really, even in between innings, they're out there kind of doing all these crazy cheers and stunts. So, yeah, it's an amazing atmosphere and definitely a lot of baseball fans there. And I got a chance to go to some games. The Nexen Heroes is a team that both Park and Jungho Gong played for before they were posted by the team. So I got to see some of their home games there at their new dome stadium called Gocheok Stadium. And then also I went to a few games at Jamsil Stadium, which is the outdoor baseball stadium where the LG Twins and Doosan Bears play. And that's kind of right by where the Olympics were held in Seoul in 88. So pretty cool atmosphere at both stadiums. You know, talked to a lot of executives, scouts, you know, agents based in Korea, some players, a lot of people involved in Korean baseball, just to kind of get a feel for it. And so, yeah, there'll be a lot of stories coming on kind of, you know, Korean baseball in general, on Byung-ho Park and kind of some background on him, you know, who kind of are the big stars there now, who could come over and make an impact like we've seen so far. Because right now, you know, there's seven major leaguers, you know, that are from Korea that are in the major leagues right now. And you can definitely tell that because they even sell authentic MLB gear throughout MLB stores and throughout the city. They kind of have the seven major leaguers patch. They have a lot of that memorabilia and a lot of the, you know, jerseys and hats that you can buy there. So, yeah, like I said, there's just a ton of, you know, you can tell it's a country that really loves their baseball because there's MLB stuff pretty much everywhere you look.
Absolutely, yeah. I know from my own experience covering Shin-Soo-Chu in Cleveland back in the day just how rabid that fan base is. And, I mean, literally there was no nugget of information about Chu on or off the field too big or too small. That they had interest in. So I can only imagine how much that's exploded in the time since as more players have infiltrated the big leagues. And yeah, Rhett, more coming. You know, I've talked to scouts who get over there, and they say from a position player side, the talent over there is probably on par or better within Japan at this point. So certainly interesting to see how that all develops, and look forward to your work on the Twins website. There is one article on there that's worth checking out about the marketing elements behind this, some interesting stuff. As the Twins market themselves in a new market entirely, with Park being part of the club. But, Rhett, while you were gone, things did not get significantly better for the Twins. Some bad injury news here. First of all, Glenn Perkins, as we figured, things were trending towards shoulder surgery there. He's done for the year. And also Phil Hughes. He'll require surgery for thoracic outlet syndrome. So, that's two key members of the pitching staff lost a season-ending surgery within a couple weeks of each other.
Yeah, definitely tough news. And last year, both those guys had tough seasons, at least in the second half there. You know, obviously 2 years ago, Hughes was the Twins' best starting pitcher, you know, broke the MLB record for strikeout-to-walk ratio, had a great season, got rewarded with a contract extension. And then last year really kind of struggled and had a tough year and, you know, kind of got back into better shape coming into this year. There were high hopes for him to kind of bounce back and have a better season. Didn't really happen, really struggled early. There's people kind of questioning, you know, what was going on with him, and he kept saying he was healthy. Sure enough, you know, he gets hit, you know, goes to the bullpen and then gets hit in the knee by a line drive. You know, and it would have kept him out for most of the season anyway, I think. And then sure enough, you know, he did have, you know, this thoracic outlet syndrome as well in his shoulders. He's going to have part of his rib removed and miss the rest of the year. I think they're hopeful that he'll be ready for spring training, but still a tough loss for this team, a guy they had a lot of, you know, a lot invested in and a lot of hopes in, and same kind of thing with Perkins. You know, Perkins last year was perfect in save opportunities in the first half of the season, was an all-star for a third straight year, you know, got the, I think it was the save, at least pitched the ninth inning of the all-star game, and then second half, you know, had a lot of injuries, some kind of neck and, you know, even some shoulder back things last year, and sure enough, this year it's been more of the shoulder thing here, and tried to pitch through it, tried to get, you know, throw some bullpens to get back to it, and sure enough, it just kept kind of not responding properly. And after finally checking with a doctor out in Los Angeles, Dr. Alatrash, who's the Dodgers team doctor, it was determined that surgery would be the best recourse. Perkins said he has no regrets in terms of choosing to, you know, kind of rehab it instead of getting surgery right away, because that was kind of even the doctor told him that was the right course of action. There was a chance that, you know, maybe it would get better if he kept rehabbing it and kind of resting it and waiting, but it never really got to that point. It kept kind of where he could throw off flat ground and be fine, but then, you know, once he kind of got on that mound, it kept bothering him. So he'll have the surgery, and he's expected to be ready for spring training as well. So at least in that sense, they'll both you know, hopefully not miss, you know, the beginning of next year. But with, you know, with Perkins with a shoulder surgery, though, you never really know. You know, the odds of coming back from that are a little bit tough. You know, Tommy John, much, much higher, you know, success rate. This is definitely a chance. This could be, you know, a career-altering surgery for him. You never know how he's going to respond. You know, same with Hughes. So, yeah, it's going to be kind of interesting to see if these guys can bounce back next year or if these are, you know, two guys that are in their early 30s, if these are kind of, the, you know, kind of career-altering, you know, injuries here.
Yeah, from what I read about Perkins' surgery, they go in there and find it was even worse than they thought. That was the labrum detached from the bone. So he was obviously trying to work through some major damage there and ultimately just not able to do it. And but you're right, Rhett. Given that age and that specific area you're talking about, it's tough. So he's got a long road ahead of him. It's a short road back for Miguel Sanó. He should be back soon, although they did extend his rehab a little bit to get him more at bats and allowed to sort of find his hitting stroke. But what's the expectation here with Sanó? Because obviously the right field experiment wasn't going particularly well. You know, could his return come at Park's expense in any way in terms of playing time? What do you anticipate here?
Yeah, it's a good question. You're right. It definitely could happen with Yvonneau. Park has definitely struggled recently. I'm not so sure if they'll decide to option Park yet. I mean, there's certainly been some talk of that even. But I think they'd rather see him kind of work through his issues in the major leagues. And they also truthfully have a big Yvonneau Park day coming up here at Target Field on July 5th. And I'm sure they'd like him to be at, but maybe, you know, option somebody else and maybe see Park see a little bit less playing time and let Sanó DH a little bit here and there. And they said they're not really, you know, probably maybe see some time at third base, but obviously Kloof's there. He's kind of also in a little bit of a slump right now as well. The right field will probably still see time there. It's still kind of be his primary position to see, you know, his playing time there. But they kind of want to see him get going a little bit here, and, you know, during his rehab assignment. Hasn't really happened yet offensively. Once he kind of gets going offensively here, he should be up, you know, probably within a couple days. And it'll be a big boost if he can kind of get back to the offense he provided last year in the second half. Would be a big welcome for this team. His, you know, first half before the injury, you know, he kind of would show spurts of it. He'd get in these kind of like home run streaks almost where it kind of home runs kind of kept him in bunches. But I'd kind of hoping for a little bit more consistency from him, maybe cut back on those strikeouts a little bit. So, yeah, it would definitely be a very interesting thing to watch second half. To see if he can kind of get back to that same guy he was as a rookie and kind of get out of the sophomore slump a little bit.